the briefings from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all these other things, and you begin to see the magnitude of the responsibility. They usually come out of those meetings pretty sober-faced, like, hey, I've seen some new things, and it's not quite the way I thought it was. Well, it's a little bit about Solomon. And so he's relating that to himself, and he says, therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours? And then what did God do? What was the result of that prayer? Does anyone?
I'll do what you've asked.
Okay. Okay, I'll give you a wise and discerning heart. And he also says, if you'll keep, in verse 14, if you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I'll also lengthen your days. And he also talked about that there will not be a time where there's not someone from your lineage on the throne of David. Well, you look at David, at Solomon's life, and if you look at this next little passage here in 4:24 through 26, why don't actually we could? I'm just going to have to cite it because it is fairly long. But as you look at this, and you see what God did in verse 24, they had peace all around the whole kingdom as a result of that. And Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And he had governors in each one of these areas so that once a month people came and brought supplies to him. And there was no lack of supply. And in verse 29 it says, God gave Solomon wisdom, exceedingly great understanding, and a largeness of heart like the sand of the seashore. And it says, for he was wiser than all the men. And verse 32 it said, he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spoke of trees, from the cedar of Lebanon, even to hyssop, that springs out of the wall. And he spoke about animals and birds and creeping things and fish. And men of all the nations and all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Well, Solomon was a very broad-thinking person. And it wasn't, he wasn't just confined to one area of life that he was thinking about. But he is a horticulturist, and he loved animals, and he loved farming and all the other things that were involved. He was very broad in his thinking. And so you have this little bit of background. Now, there was a forewarning in the Scripture, and we'll just read this in Deuteronomy 17, about all the kings, and how many kings were before Solomon?
Two.
So it wasn't, I mean, it's pretty contemporary, wasn't it? But let's look at Deuteronomy 17. I often thought if a president would take this passage, in fact, I did write a letter to President Clinton referring to this passage, and I thought this would be a good passage for you to read in starting your presidency. I don't know if he ever got it, but we'll see what happens. But look at this passage once in Deuteronomy 17. Now here's some admonitions that God is saying to the king. So if someone would like to read that once, 16 through, actually we should read through 19. Okay?
The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. And he must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself a scroll, a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are Levites. is to be with him, and he's to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees.
Okay. Now, what specifically were the things that he was supposed to do? Or not do, or... Three things he wasn't supposed to do, and one thing he was supposed to do. What was it?
Acquire a great number of horses.
Okay. Don't get a lot of horses, and especially from where?
Egypt.
Okay, don't go back to Egypt to get your horses. What else? Okay. Don't multiply wives. And what else? Okay. Now that was the positive thing.
Don't accumulate silver and gold.
Okay, don't multiply the silver and gold. And then he says, now get the picture here in verse 19, or 17, or 18 and 19. He was supposed to go to the priest, and the priest gave him a scroll of the book of the law of Moses, the first five books. And what was he supposed to do with it?
Write
it himself. He was supposed, you know, it'd take some time, wouldn't it? To go and scribe it yourself in your own handwriting. And then the admonition was, you read that how often?
Every day.
And why? Why were you to read it every day? Okay, so is that something that just comes naturally to learn, you know, to revere the Lord your God? All of us are testimony to the fact that it's a lifelong process, isn't it? We came to know Christ in a moment, but we live until the day we die in that pursuit of knowing the Lord. And that's what he's saying there. Hey, you read this all the days of your life that you may learn to fear the Lord your God and be careful to observe all the things that are contained in this law. And then there's another thing. Why? In verse 20. Someone look at that. Yeah. So your heart isn't lifted above your brothers. And even though you're king, don't forget you're just a man. And don't forget that you're a brother among brothers. Is that relevant today? Huh? Is that relevant in Christian circles today? Sure it is. Why do men fail, like some of the evangelists and things that we've seen fall, you know, kind of crater before us? Why?
They separate themselves and elevate.
Yeah. They become above the law, and they feel like, hey, I'm a law unto myself. And it really doesn't apply to me because I'm so blessed by God and spiritual. Wait till you see the contrast of men who fall. You see it in Solomon's life too. The very same things happen. So that's the admonition, right? It's pretty clear. Now let's look at what Solomon did. Let's go back to 1 Kings. And when he first starts out, 1 Kings 2, David also gives him some instruction. So if someone would read that little instruction that his dad gave him when he took the throne, 2:1-4.
As David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon his son, saying, I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn.
Okay. Was that pretty clear? It's the same admonition as out of Deuteronomy, isn't it? Hey, you be sure to keep the law of the Lord your God. You be sure to do that. Now let's see what Solomon did. Now here's the wisest man on earth. And let's see, we're going to look at his life really in three 20-year periods. Because he comes on the throne when he's about 20. And he spends 20 years in the middle of his life building the temple and carrying out the instructions of David his father. And the next 20 years is a period of his life that I feel like the first period of life. It says, you know, he wrote how many psalms? 3,000. And how many? I mean, 3,000 proverbs. And how many psalms? Okay. Here's a godly man. Here's a man that when we read the psalms and we read proverbs, we're reading from the wisdom of Solomon. We see a man that he is taking the admonition of David his father, and he is applying it. And God is blessing him and using him in a very great way. But we also see the next 20 years, the last 20 years of his life, in chaos. And we see him drifting and going away from the Lord. And yet, in the midst of it, you know, God is still at work, and he recognizes that. But I want to trace through sort of the seeds, as it were, of David's downfall. I mean, Solomon's downfall. And it's found in the first verse that I've got there, 1 Kings 7:8. And let's see what he did. Someone read that.
In his house where he was to live, the other court inwards in the hall was of the same workmanship. He also made a house like this for Pharaoh's daughter, whom Solomon had married.
What did he do?
Married a whore.
Huh?
Married a whore.
Went after a horse.
Yeah, he got a horse. He got a horse in Egypt. You know, when I first read this years ago, I thought, well, that was kind of an innocent thing. Perhaps it was a liaison, you know, the kingdoms and so forth. And, you know, in those days, royalty sort of passed around and daughters and so forth. Maybe it was just kind of a arranged deal. But anyway, Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. I mean, how close to Egypt can you get? Now you look at, you say, well, that seems kind of innocent, but let's look at 2 Chronicles 8:11. And someone read that once.
Then Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up to see David in the house which he had built. He said, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy, for the ark of the Lord is in it.
What did he do? What was the situation there? He just got through 20 years of building the temple and all that. And what did he do with his wife? Huh? No?
Now he built a separate house because he didn't want her going in there because he probably knew already.
Do you think he was a little convicted about the situation? He said, hey, I cannot have my Egyptian wife living in Jerusalem because that's where the Ark of the Covenant is. I mean, I think he recognized what the danger was. And so he builds another house outside for her to dwell in. Okay, now let's look at 1 Kings 11:1-3.
Any man who moved his wife out of his house, out of her house, is in trouble.
Okay, there you go. Now let's look at, now this is describing Solomon's life later on. And let's look at this in 1 Kings 11. Okay, it's on the sheet there. 1 Kings 11:1-3, 1-13. But what we're going to do is we're going to go back here into 10, and we're going to take this 1 Kings 10:14-29 first, just a page over. When you look at Solomon's life, in the first part of this, 14 through 18, it's talking about one thing. What is it? Gold and silver. In verse 18, it says, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with what? With pure gold. Now you think, well, that's nice. It's a, you know, it's a great deal, a king to have a throne like that. It's great. Look at verse 21. Okay, all the vessels that were they were drinking out of were pure gold. And verse 23, what does that say?
Greater than all the kings in earth, on the earth, and riches.
Okay, and riches and wisdom. And it says, all the earth sought the presence of the king Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. And each man brought presents, articles of silvers and gold and garments and armor and spices and horses and mules at a set rate by year. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. And he gathered 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen who he stationed in all the chariot cities. And King Solomon made silver. Huh?
As common as
stones in Jerusalem. And he made cedar as abundant as the sycamores, which are in the lowland. And Solomon had horses imported from Egypt. Oops. What was one of the admonitions? Don't multiply horses. What was another admonition? Don't multiply silver and gold. Okay? Look at verse 11, or chapter 11. 1 to 4. Someone read that once.
King Solomon. You said 1 Kings 11?
Yeah.
King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were the nations about which the Lord told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been.
Okay. What did he do? Now here's the wisest man on earth. Yeah.
The significance that King James began with bet. King James version began, you know, from that verse 10, he gave the big bet. Bet. King Solomon had loved him.
Yeah.
Bet.
Yeah. Let's look at this a little bit. What was the admonition in Deuteronomy?
Don't do all the things I did.
Yeah. And what was the significance of not having the foreign wives? What would they do? They're going to lead your heart away. And some of you guys are single, and I think there's an admonition when you look. Is there anybody single here? Anybody still looking? Okay, great. You know, if you look at Proverbs 31, a lot of you guys are familiar with this passage, but look at Proverbs 31. And of course, we talk about this as the 31 wife.
Proverbs 31 wife.
But look at verse 11 in Proverbs 31. You know, it's asked the questions in verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife, for her worth is far above rubies? Then it says, the heart of her husband safely trusts in her, so they have no lack of gain. And guys, I've seen that over and over and over again, that no matter how you slice it, when you are involved with a wife, and you have a wife, you literally turn your heart over to her. And you say, I am in control, but she really has the control of your heart. And I've seen men who really wanted to be used of God or wanted to be involved in a ministry, and if the wife is not with him, he's not involved. He's not involved. I remember one time we had a guy, we were trying to get him out at the base and everything, and his wife was a nice Christian gal, but she wasn't really keen on this idea of the navigators and so forth. And he, whenever we had something, he was never available. Well, I always had this, I had that, you know, different things. So we made a little project to get her involved, and we invited her over to the house and so forth, and she sang very beautifully. So we had a rally, and one of the specific things we wanted at this rally, putting the rally on us so we could have her sing. And so we had her sing and so forth. Well, she thought this was an okay deal. And, you know, suddenly he was available. He was available because his wife's heart was there. And this is the same principle that Solomon, hey, you be careful what you marry, because if you don't, she will turn your heart away from God. And that's why the scripture says, don't be unequally yoked together with an unbeliever, because they will turn your heart away from God. And this is exactly what happened to Solomon's life right here. He had these little honeys around, and I'm sure that one of the little honeys came around and said, hey, Solomon, I really appreciate Jerusalem, and I enjoy the fact that you've got a temple there, but hey, I'm from Sidon, or I'm from, you know, up north, and there's no place for me to worship. And Solomon says, oh, honey, man, that's a little deal. Let's build you a little shrine over here, or a little temple over here, and you can go do that. But what happened in Solomon's later life? He began to go worship there too. And how did God respond to all that?
Now the Lord was angry with Solomon.
Okay. You can see it, can't you?
No candy coated.
Huh? That's what it says. In verse 6, Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow or fully follow the Lord as did his father, David. And then Solomon built, you know, a high place and another high place east of Jerusalem and Molech, the abomination of Ammon. And he did likewise for how many?
All.
How many temples did he build?
700.
Yeah. Whatever their faith was, man, he built it. I mean, talk about an ecumenical deal here in Jerusalem. That's really what it was.
The World Council of Churches.
Right. It started right there. In verse 9, what does it say? Someone read 9 and 10.
The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting here. It says, did you catch that little deal? The Lord appeared, even though God appeared to him twice, Solomon missed the mark. And I've heard men, and I've said it to myself sometimes, and I've heard people more. You know, if God would just visit me, you know, I'd be hooked forever. That ain't the case. Here's a man, we often think that if I just got a special visitation from God, then I would believe, or I'd follow, or I'd do what God wanted me to do. Here's Solomon, who got a special visitation from God twice and gave special dispensation to Solomon with wisdom, and he still missed the mark. So, what's some conclusions? As I look at this in studying the book of Ecclesiastes, I think that what Solomon is really sharing in this book is the process that he went through to try to find meaning in life. And that's really what he's talking about. And he's looking at mankind, he's looking at man, and he's trying to figure this out. Now, many scholars say, well, you know, we could say that here's a king using wisdom of man and not the wisdom of God, and there's a real difference between the two. And that could be a very plausible deal. But I think Solomon is going through this little midlife crisis in his life, and he's looking back on all that God did and looking at man, and he's embroiled with all these wives and things around and just in kind of an intellectual mess trying to sort it out. And that's why I think that the wisdom that's in this book is so contemporary to our society today. And the reason why I say that it's so contemporary is because as we get into these questions that he's asking, these are questions that men ask down through the ages. And the beauty of the book of Ecclesiastes is because God gave unusual ability and wisdom to Solomon, he was able to pursue out to the nth degree each one of these avenues that he went to pursue, and he could come to the end of it and say, what? It's vanity. It doesn't hold water. And he'd retract and run out to another one, and he'd run to the end of it. And what was the conclusion? Vanity. And he'd run another. And so we have this book. So let's look at it. Let's look at the book of Ecclesiastes.
Bruce?
Yeah.
Is there any indication anywhere that he actually copied the law and read it every day? Even though he did the Proverbs, he did the Psalms, is there any indication in your study that he ever did that?
I don't recall. Maybe any of you other guys did. I don't believe so. I know this was a standard admonition to the king, and I'm not sure if he personally did it or not. I mean, it's certainly there's, as you go through Proverbs and Psalms and you see the wisdom, you see a lot of direct quotations and that out of the book of law and musings about it. But I don't know if he actually did it.
You know, you could speculate that he probably did something of that along that order the first years of his time, and especially as he was probably building the temple, but somewhere along the line he deviated. He took 7 years to build the temple and 13 years to build the palace.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there the things got out of balance.
You know, he's 20 years building his own house and the temple. And I think, as I reflect, I bet you those were really spiritual years for him. You couldn't help but take all these plans and all the measurements and all the detail and the priesthood and all the things that were involved in building this temple and not have a spiritual experience. You know, I think many pastors do that. You know, you go through this building program and this, I mean, it's a great fun deal and you got all this splendor. But once you get it, and the kingdom is built, that's when you're really vulnerable.
Inventory.
Yeah, and I think that's where Solomon was. So let's look at this book. And the first question in verse 3 in chapter 1, he asks a question. Someone read that once.
What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun?
You know, that's a good question, isn't it? What's the end result of all the effort that you expend in your life? What's the end result? And he says, you know, there's one generation goes and another generation comes. The sun rises and the sun goes down. You know, the wind goes here and the wind goes there and the seas go in. You know, the rivers run and they go to the sea and it's not filled up. And as he looked at all that, I mean, you know, that's where he makes the statement, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, and really we could say that today too, is there? When it comes to man himself, there's nothing new under the sun. So he's asking the question, you know, what profit is there? And one of the avenues that he was going to pursue is in verse 13 of chapter, half chapter 1. Someone read that once, verse 13.
I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith.
Okay. What did he do? He set his heart to search out the meaning of life, the reason of things. The same quotation is in 7:25. And he expands it out a little bit in 7:25, where he says, I applied my heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom in the reason of things, even to know wickedness of folly and of foolishness and madness. The whole gamut. The whole gamut of life. I'm going to check it out. And then look at 8:16. He kind of adds another dimension. He says, when I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on the earth, even though one sees no sleep or day or night and so forth, and he says, I saw the work that of God, and man cannot find out the work that is done in the heaven and so forth. So he's saying, hey, I'm going to throw caution to the wind, and I'm going to check it all out. Do you ever see guys do that? Have you ever seen a guy do that? Throw caution to the wind and check it all out? Boy, I have. And we'll camp on that in a couple of verses here. Well, let's look at how he did it. In chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, gives a little synopsis of how he checked it all out. Someone read verse 1, or 1 to 3.
I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish, and what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guilding me. My mind still guiding me to wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives.
Okay. He did recognize that men are here just a few days. You know, Psalm 90, verse 12. Teach me to number my days. We saw that. But what did he do? He says, I'm going to enjoy pleasure to the hilt, right? I mean, put that in the context of how many wives and concubines. I mean, do you think he figured out sex? Yeah, he did. He figured that out with gusto. And he said, really, in verse 3, he says, I'm not going to withhold anything that's going to gratify my flesh. And he did it. Now look at the next verses. He said, I made great works. I built myself houses and planted vineyards. Do you think that was a fun project? And you look at Solomon now, I mean, how much gold did he have?
More than I wish anybody else had more.
Unlimited. How much wisdom did he have? Unlimited. And so I think that, I mean, talk about building the fantasies of man in architectural works. I mean, he had it to do. And he pursued it, brought it out to the nth degree, hanging gardens, you know, pools. And he goes on to describe there. He says, I made myself gardens and orchards, planted all kinds of fruit trees in. He imported fruit trees from all over the world and had irrigation systems for it. I mean, that's a fun deal. I mean, I sit there, I would drool. I mean, I sit there, and one of my little prayer list things is to build a cabin sometime, you know. And, you know, that's kind of sitting back there, you know. And, you know, that'd be a big deal. But Solomon, I mean, just do it. Magnificent temple, the most beautiful temple. And he got a chance to do it. Okay? And he says, I had water pools. I watered the groves. I had male servants, female servants. I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem and the whole area. I mean, there's a lot of times that I think back in my roots and I think, gee, it'd be fun just to get on the tractor and, you know, go plow 180 and just smell the earth again and, you know, get in the barn and the cows and just do it. I mean, that was fun. No worry. No worry, John. I mean, John's got the best job on the whole earth. I mean, he just plays in the ground and sees it grow up and rejoices when the hail comes and the bugs eat it up and all that stuff. But we all have these little ideas. If I could just do that, then I'd be happy, right? What does Solomon come up with? Well, that didn't satisfy him. And he said, I had female singers. I had delights of musical instruments of all kinds. I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. And also my wisdom remained with me. Throughout all this pursuit, I still had that wisdom intact. I could reason it through. I could think it through. And that's why the book is so good. He says, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep them from them. Whatever I wanted, I did. And isn't that the ideal thought that people have in the back of their mind? When you talk to somebody, huh? Just give me the freedom to do what I want to do, and I'll be happy. And you know, if I took a poll of every one of you guys here, and I said, you know, how much money you make this year? Is it enough? And how about you? And if we went around and did a poll, you know, it'd be very interesting. Because maybe McNally over here says, hey, it's not enough. And I go over to Larry Guest and said, gee, if I even made close to what he did, I'd be really happy. And, you know, we go around and not one of us would sit there and say, hey, I've got plenty. I'm really satisfied with where I am. And that's the same pursuit, because Solomon says here, you know, that in verse 8 of chapter 1, he says, you know, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear satisfied with hearing. And later on he says, hey, you know, whatever my eyes wanted to have, I got it. And what did it produce?
Vanity and vexation of spirit.
Yeah, vanity and vexation of spirit. He says, I looked in all the works, in verse 11, 2:11, that my hands have done, and in the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed it was all vanity, as a grasping of the wind. There was no profit under the sun. It didn't satisfy. I would say that when we're talking to men, and even to ourselves, sometime in the conversation it's going to come out, you know, if I just got that promotion, just got that job, just got this, just got that, just got this, if my wife was different, you know, and on and on and on, I'd be happy. And I think we can go back to this guy and say, listen, here's Solomon, who had the wisdom of God and every opportunity available, and he came to the same conclusion, it's not going to satisfy you. There's got to be something more. And of course, we'll go into that a little later. So what's his conclusion? In verse 17 and 18, someone read that. Now, chapter 2.
So I hated life because of the work that was done in the sun, because of the work that was done in the sun, was grievous to me.
Uh-huh.
All of his meaningless, the chasing after the wind. I hated all of it.
Yeah.
I hated all the things I had told.
Now, what's his conclusion there? What does he say?
He's obviously going to have to give it away.
Okay. Is that a reality? You know what? The reality for every one of us sitting in this room, and I think it's a very keen reality that we've got to accept, is that no matter what you're doing, no matter what project you're working on, no matter what research or development you're doing, or what ministry you've got, or anything, you know what? The reality is, you are going to have to turn it over to somebody else. And that's a tough reality, isn't it? But I think it's a reality that we need to burn into our souls and realize that's just it. That's life. There's nothing that you can take with you back. We'll go into some more details on that. That's a reality. Everything that we have, we got from somebody else, basically, because somebody had to turn it over to us, and we're going to pass it on to somebody else. And Solomon says, what kind of guy is going to be after I leave? What's he going to be like? And I don't know that. I don't have any assurances of that. And that's grievous to me. But if you're living for just the moment now and the gratification of the flesh, that is really going to be a tough pill to swallow. And I've seen men who have had very responsible jobs, and they get their watch and a pat on the back, and it's over. And they can walk out of that office, and they're never consulted again. It's like they didn't exist. And the new guy is standing in the wings, waiting for him to leave, and he walks into his office and takes over everything that he ever did and runs with it. And that's reality. Every one of us are in the same boat.
Someone's going to get the watch.
Yeah. Most of us get the boot. Right. Yeah.
On your handout?
Yeah.
Is there a typo on that?
Where's that?
It's two.
Oh, did I?
Somebody else in chapter one.
Okay.
And it could be chapter two, could it?
You're right, and I'm glad you did that.
Okay. Not so much for today, but you do it again.
Well, I guess. Here. I went over that thing, and still missed it, huh?
But you wrote it.
I wrote it. There you go. Even my spell check wouldn't pick that up, huh? So I hated life. And he says, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor I toiled in verse 20. I toil under sun, for there is a man whose labor is with wisdom and knowledge and skill. I mean, he really did a good job. And what did he have to do? He said, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. He said, this is also vanity, and it's grievous, and so forth. Well, those are some where he's going and what he's looking at. But in the midst of it, I think there's some valuable lessons that he's picking up out of here that can really be, yeah.
Wait, when he makes the statement there too about that there's no one to leave it to and you don't know what's going to happen, do you suppose there's some...
Let's look at some of the basic principles that he comes up with as he's going through this. One of the conclusions is in 2:14, and we're going to look up several verses in this area. 2:14 is, what does it say? Huh? It says the same event happens to all of them. You can be a wise man, a fool, rich, poor, whatever it is. The fact is, you're going to die. Look at 8:8 once. Someone read that.
8:1, is that what you're saying?
8:8. You can just add that in there.
There's no man that hath power over the Spirit or retains the Spirit. King James. Uh-huh. He that hath power in the day of death, and there is no discharge in that war. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it.
Okay. You know, I've looked at that verse many times, and I've put it in this context. You know, there's no discharge in the battle of death, is there? We're all going to go through it. And the fight that we have with evil, when does that quit? Huh? Until you get that last rattle on your bed and die, you're going to be fighting it. And in our contemporary society, a lot of times we think, somewhere I'm going to graduate in the Christian life. I'm going to kind of come up to a plateau where the struggle's over. I can get in my motorhome and drive off in the sunset, you know, and just sort of feast on all I've labored all the life, and it's just going to be rosy.
Yeah, I just talked with Jan, a motorhome. He said it wasn't true.
It wasn't true. You know, isn't that society, though? Isn't that what they're purveying on us, the idea? That you kind of graduate out of it. And Solomon's saying, hey, there's no discharge in that battle. And, you know, one of the interesting things, look at verse 9, verse 5. Chapter 9, verse 5. Someone read that once.
For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything.
Okay. Go ahead.
Neither have they any more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten.
Okay, what does that say? It says the living know they're going to die, but the dead don't know anything. Let's spiritualize that a little bit. What is that saying?
The dead don't know they're dead.
Okay. The dead don't know they're dead. And I think there's a point where he says, in Psalm 90, verse 12, teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. Why do we need to number our days to be able to apply our hearts to wisdom? Huh?
Because death is the final chapter of birth.
Yeah. And so, if I do not really reckon with the fact that I'm going to die, it says the living know they're going to die. And they make preparation for that in Psalm 90, verse 12. But the dead just keep ignoring the fact, and you see people who are, I mean, you know, they're on their way out and they're still denying it, that they're going to die. They think that they're immortal. They think that it's going to go on forever. And people do all this crazy stuff to try to prevent it, and it's going to happen. There's no discharge. But for us, that's a reality that should keep us focused in on the main things of life and keep us focused in so that we don't get caught up in losing the perspective that, hey, everything I do, everything I have, I can't take it with me, so I better make the value judgment about it. And I better live with that perspective. If I lose sight of that, I'm going to end up with a lot of the same things that happened to Solomon and other people because they don't keep that in perspective. And, you know, the facts are, is that, you know, all of us are going to go through that. And sickness and sorrow and all those things are part of life. There's prosperity. There's days that were you know, great days. There's bad days. And he says, you know, in 7, 13, and 14, he says, consider the work of God, and for who can make it straight, and when he has made it crooked. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider, surely God has appointed one as well as the other, so that no man can find nothing that will happen after him. What's he saying there? What's the lesson that we have to learn about that? Is it true that when you accepted Christ that you kind of got a bed of roses and no more adversity? Huh? Did that happen? Is that not sort of some of the contemporary teaching in the modern church? That somehow you escape all that if you accept Christ? Name it and claim it and that kind of idea. You shouldn't, I mean, your business shouldn't fail if you're a Christian. But Solomon is saying, hey, listen, there's a day of prosperity and be joyful. But there's also going to be a day of adversity, and that's also from the hand of God. Now, put that in contemporary when Paul was talking about it. What did he say about that? I have learned in Philippians 4:13, you know, that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But what precedes that? Huh? Yeah. He says, I've gone through abundance, and I've gone through leanness, and I've learned that whatsoever state I am, therein to be content. Why? Because through Christ I can do everything. And this is the same lesson. Nothing new under the sun. And Solomon is saying, hey, here it is. In the days of darkness, look at verse 11, 7 and 8. Chapter 11, 7 and 8. Someone read that once.
Light is sweet and it pleases the eyes to the sun. However many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything to come is meaningless.
Okay. In what is he basically saying there that we can apply?
Take full advantage of the years you've got, the time you've got. Because after it's gone, it's gone.
Okay. Take full advantage, enjoy it. But no. Yeah.
This is a bad time when you're going to be right along the side.
Yeah. Know that the days of darkness are going to be many. Let's apply that. You know, how many of you guys are gone on a vacation and, you know, you just had a great time and it's kind of like this little bubble of protection. You know, you go out there and everything is just going so great and you're having a good time. And you come home and you open the door and the freezer went out and it's, you know, it's melted all over the floor. Or you go, you have this mound of clothes and you take and put it in the washer and the washer breaks down, or, you know, the car blew up on the, I mean, even in the midst of all the fun, right on the heels of it, or in the next of it, this thing, how did this happen? It just blew up. And I think that's life. That's it. There is life like that. And we need to reckon with it. So he says, hey, this is the way it is. Verse 5:15, down there he says, naked I came into the world, and naked I'm going to go, and I can't take one thing with me. And that's a vanity. That's something I can't get a hold of. And that's the way it is. That's the life. But on the positive side, as he's going through here, he's giving, in chapter 3, an overview, and of course we've heard songs written about this and so forth. He says in chapter 3:1, to everything there's a season and there's a time for every purpose under heaven. And then he goes through a whole bunch of things. There is a time to be born, but there's also a time to die. You know, there is a time to plant, but there's also a time to harvest. And there's a time to heal, but there's also a time to break down or break up. There's a time to weep, and there's a time to laugh. Now, what happens is you go through this list, and you get them out of sequence. What happens to a farmer if you get out of sequence? Yeah, you're going to miss your crop. And if you don't plant at the right season, you know, you can't get in the field or you can't do it, what happens? The other end of it doesn't work either, does it? It doesn't work. Up in Minnesota last summer, they couldn't get in the fields until way late. And usually the corn is, you know, we figure knee-high by the 4th of July. And we went through and some of the corn was just coming up about like that. Well, my cousins never got a harvest. You know, they had to chop it up and make cattle feed out of it again many years. And it was out of sequence. It didn't work.
Expensive silage.
Yeah, expensive silage. But there's a purpose. Now let's look at the wisdom as Solomon is, and we're kind of taking snapshots here, and it's like he's going along and he's kind of sorting these things out, and then all of a sudden it's like the light comes on and he drops in some wisdom of God for us to chew on. And that's found at the end of this, or part of this, chapter 3. Let's look at 9, 10, and 11. 3, 9, 10, and 11. He's asking the question again, what profit has the worker from all that he labors? And then he mentions three things. Someone read that.
I've seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end.
Okay. Now let's look at that. He says, I've seen a God-given task that is given to man. In the context of what we've been talking about in this chapter, what would you say the God-given task is?
Okay.
To work? Okay, well, that's later on, and he mentions that. But I think the God-given task that he's given there is in the context of being born and sowing and reaping and figuring out the seasons and your family and life and all those things. That's a God-given task. Yeah, life. That's it. Yeah, in the timing, in right timing. And then he says, he's made everything beautiful in his time. What is that? What's he talking about?
Everything has a place and everything has a place. Back up to 3:1.
Okay. But there's a season, there's a timing. Some of you guys saw that deal on Ted Bundy, right? Now, is sex beautiful?
In the right place.
But you get it out of the context, is it beautiful? It's really ugly. And you get life out of its sequence. You get life out of harmony in which God has put it, and it's not beautiful anymore. You live in harmony in the season and in harmony with God, it's beautiful. Relationships are beautiful. And all the things that are involved in life. Well, the key there is, he says, and he's also put eternity in their hearts. What's he talking about?
His love.
Okay.
He's given us all a sense that this is not all there is to it.
Okay. And as we follow that out, you know, that thought of being able to put, he's put eternity in their hearts. Let's jump over to 12:5, and kind of, there's another reference there you can put on the side. Someone read that once.
Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place. 12:5?
Yeah.
And of terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. For man goes to his eternal home, while mourners go about in the streets.
Okay. So he's talking about the fact that God has placed eternity in man's heart, and in the context of that verse, he says, you know, in one way, we don't know which is the beginning and the end. We can't figure out God. And all of us, we think we have a little figure out of that. But the fact is, you know, if this world keeps on going, you know, 20 years or 30 years or 50 years or 100 years from now, there are going to be conferences going on. Not one of us are going to be here. And it's like we didn't even exist. But yet God is still going. And the same values, the same principles, everything else is trying to keep going in the heart of man. And there's eternity in my heart. And man goes to his eternal home. And in verse 7 he says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And that's part of that, that whole life cycle. But let's go back and see what he tells us about that accountability. We got to go back to chapter 3 and look at verse 15 and 17. The first part of it, he says, I know in 14 that whatever God does, it shall be forever. That's the eternity again. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. And God does it that men should fear before him. When man understands that he has eternity in his heart and that he is part of God's eternal plan, what it should do is put fear in his heart, because he knows he's accountable to a living God. And that's what he's talking about here in verse 15. That which has already been and what has been already, God requires an account of what is past. That's a little dimension he puts in there. God will require an accounting of your past. And look at verse 17. Someone read that once.
I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man by a time where every matter and for every deed is there.
Okay. And mine says every purpose and every work, that we're going to be brought into that judgment. Let's go to 11:9. And here's a little passage through the end of 12 that puts this in perspective. And he says, okay, you remember now, I pursued every pleasure, everything that I could, my eyes could think about or whatever it was. Hey, I did it. There's nothing new under the sun. I did it. So he says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But, what?
Know that God will bring these things to you.
Okay, know thou, for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So, Solomon's saying, hey, I don't do things in a vacuum, do I? And I can pursue all this stuff in my heart and whatever I want to do, but I am accountable to the eternity that's in my heart. I'm accountable to eternal God. And he says, okay, in verse 12, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come, and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in him. Remember that. And then let's look at verse 6. Remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher scattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the well. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. What's he saying there? When he uses those little metaphors of the golden bowl and the silver cord and all.
Before you check out.
Yeah. And it's like a thread before it's broken. or the bowl before it decomposes, or some, there's a, there it is. And then he says in verse 14 of chapter 12, what's that?
God will bring every act to judgment.
Okay, does that sound like a New Testament verse? Huh? Is there anything new in the Old or New Testament? No, it's the same message. God has placed eternity in our hearts, and we're accountable to an eternal God. And he says, God will bring every work into judgment. And every secret thing, whether it's good or whether it's evil. That's the accountability. And Solomon had to learn that, you know, in a pursuit of every area of life. He had to learn that. And he come to that conclusion. That's where it's at. And so, as we look at his some of the things that he discovers, and I'll jump down to number 8 there, that you and I have a responsibility to God for this life. And we've looked at a couple of verses there. And verse 13 is a key verse. Someone read that once.
Now all has been heard, here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments.
Okay. What's the whole duty of man?
Fear God and keep his commandments.
Fear God and keep his commandments. Now Solomon had to go through a lot to come to that conclusion, didn't he? And we see the turmoil that he goes through in his life. But he came out the other end with the right message. Huh? And I can rejoice in that. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Well, that's a wonderful conclusion to come to. And I praise the Lord that he came to that. And in the midst of it, there's still a lot. I mean, we could go through and look at all sorts of ideas that we could apply to our own life. But I'm going to apply it to some business principles that he learned in the midst of all his travels. And we'll just look at a few of them. Look at verse 8 and 9.
Verse before you leave.
Okay.
Verse 14 of chapter 3, I think, is also really convicting. He says, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him.
Uh-huh. And, you know, if we take that same theme, God so worked that men should fear him, and drop it into Romans 1 and 2, what does Paul say about it? Can you think of the verses that he talks about?
What's the question again, Bruce?
In verse 14 of 3:14, it talks about that, you know, God has done that so that men would fear before him. And when men stand before God, are they going to be able to take a finger at God and say, hey, you didn't show me? What does Romans 1 and 2 say?
God set his creation for us to...
Yeah.
I'm looking for the verse.
You know, he set his creation before us, and he's shown it openly to us. And he said, there's not one man going to be able to stand before him and put his finger at him and say, you didn't tell me. Because you're without excuse. I showed it in my creation. And in chapter 2, I showed it by writing it on your hearts. And I think what Solomon is referring to is he's placed eternity in your hearts. He wrote that eternal message on your heart, and you will not be able to shake it. And you will stand before God and said, I refuse the message. I refused the work that you did in my heart, and I refused you. And you're not,
without excuse.
I'm without excuse.
Titus 2, verse 11 says, the grace of God appeared to all, has appeared to all.
Uh-huh.
The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to Deuteronomy 17:19, and fear and obey God.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, you know, disobedience, of course, is what Solomon went through when he chose the wrong wife, and he began to, you know, systematically sort of add to all these things that he was getting, and he broke everything that God set him not to do. And I don't think that it was willful, I'm going to go do that. But I think that he laid off of that pursuit of seeking the Lord, and the things began to creep in, and the sex and the power and the money and the fame and the fortune and everything else. Yeah, grabbed his heart. And the downfall was there. Now, the question is, if it can happen to the wisest man on earth, what about us? Can it happen to us too? Have you seen men that have happened to? Well, I have. A vivid example of that was when I was in the Air Force. There was a young fellow that came in our squadron, and he had come from a Christian home, and he he's a Christian guy, and I kind of took him under my wing and began to disciple him a little bit, and he began to kind of question some things, and one of the old salts in my squadron, and there's always one of them, who liked to take young guys and expose them to the good things of life, and got them out drinking a little bit, and he kind of sampled that, and then he began to inquire, "Hey, have you experienced sex?" And the guy hadn't. "Well, come on out, I'll show you." And so he got him involved, and I saw a man go from a sensitive guy in 6 months was totally out to lunch. I mean, he was carousing every single night, and just his eyes and everything, I mean, he had just blown off the map. And I thought, man, that can happen fast. And it happened fast in Solomon's life too. How would you think about writing, 3,000 Proverbs and 1,000 Psalms and that kind of communion with God, and end up like 1 Kings talks about, that he is drawn away from God, and God had to come to him, I would say the third time, and say, "Solomon, I'm judging you, and you're going to lose your kingdom." Boy, I mean, if it can happen to Solomon, boy, I need to be on guard. And if I don't get the message of the book of Ecclesiastes for myself and keep eternity in view, and the fact that, hey, everything that I do apart from the grace of God and the work of God is going to burn and go up in dust, and it won't satisfy. I see men, don't you see men, who are giving their life to a job and pursuing it to the nth degree, and what does it end up? Zip. I was trying to think about how would you diagram Ecclesiastes. And I kind of put it like this. Let's say here's the core of life. And, if we want to put another circle, and we put every avenue of life coming out here, you name it, whether it's business or money or sex or, you name it. And what Solomon is saying, hey, if you take and pursue that to the nth degree, what's going to happen? It's going to end up and blow up. And most men, unlike Solomon, I mean, they get on one track and they don't have the capacity like Solomon did. It says, remember he said a couple of times, "And my wisdom didn't leave me? I went out drinking and got drunk and just crowds around, but my wisdom didn't leave me." Now, men don't have that privilege, just the common, ordinary men. And you get guys who are just tracking on business, And it isn't until they're way out at end that they come to some sort of realization, I've blown it. But it's too late, isn't it? They don't have the privilege to come back. They're already out there. Patrick Morley, in his book, The Man in the Mirror, makes the statement, no amount of success in the office can compensate for failure in the home. And I've had men in Amarillo. I had a man come to me one time and just broke down and wept. And he said, I would give you all of my money and all of my retirement if I could have a family like yours. He said, I blew it. He said, I gave everything I had to business, and I lost my family, I lost everything in it. And all I've got is money, and it doesn't mount a hill of beans. That's the message of what Solomon is talking about. You pursue that out, and you're going to end up with vanity. And I would put it this way. If you draw these and put them in, and put God in the picture, what Solomon is saying, not only will you be able to enjoy your work and your labor, and there's a lot of message in Solomon that we didn't cover about enjoying your wife because it's your heritage, and we'll cover a couple we got a few times. But if you take and have God at the center and fear Him and keep His commandments and keep eternity in your heart in that eternal view, then whatever you pursue in life can come back and draw back into the center, and it makes sense. And you can enjoy it. One of the vexing things Solomon said in chapter 6, and you can look at it here, and we'll look at it from the 5:18 on.
Chapter
6? Well, 5:18 to chapter 6, verse 3. He says, here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of his labor. See, that's the season. That's the thing that God has given to us, in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. He was talking about, hey, in the beginning of it, I've got to give my heritage away. But really, I can enjoy my heritage now. Because if I pursue it and enjoy it and do it the way God wants me to it, it's a heritage for life. And then he says, for he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joys of his heart. There's satisfaction. I think that, you know, whether I'm a rancher or whether I'm a computer operator or whatever it is, and remember that verse, he says that God gives us that in chapter 3, he occupies a task for the sons of men to be occupied with. I don't care what the occupation is, God can give you the happiness of your heart and the heritage of it, because it's part of that. And it's not wrong to enjoy that job and the thing that God has given to us. Just keep it in perspective. Don't let it get out of here so that becomes your main focus, because it'll end up in the wind. And he says there's an evil under the sun in verse 1, and it's common among men. I've seen it. He says there's a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires, and yet what happens? He doesn't have the power to enjoy it. You ever seen men like that? Yeah. You really seen men like that. We had a Bible study with some men this last week, and one of the accountants was telling this story. And he said, this is one of those stories that just breaks your heart, but he says, I knew the man, and I heard him talk and tell the story of a group of men. He said that he was a really top-notch salesman, and he got in contact with one of his friends, and the guy had a business that was doing about $500,000 a year. And so this guy asked him if he would come aboard and help him with the marketing and sales and so forth, and he'd give him 25% of the company if he would do it. And what a golden opportunity. And so the first year, they did over $3 million worth of sales. And man, he was, it was going great. And he sat down with, and obviously he was paying a pretty heavy price with his family and so forth, but he sat down with his wife and he said, you know, hon, if we can just go a little bit longer, I'm going to have enough built up that I can kind of pull back a little bit and we can enjoy more of our family. But, you know, we're kind of in this situation now and we got to pursue it. But he says, let's shoot ahead here, and in 2 weeks, we'll have a weekend together, and I'll come home on Friday, and we'll have a whole weekend. Great. And this is a Christian guy, too. We prayed about it. So, sure enough, on Thursday, what does he do?
Call.
He got a call. One of the biggest clients wanted to see him Friday afternoon. So he called his wife and he said, hon, he said, man, I know I made a promise. And he said, what I'll do, I'll come home and we'll have lunch together and I'll go see this client and I'll come home Friday night and we'll have all the weekend together. And he did it. Came home, had lunch. But he said, you know, the whole time I was having lunch and I greeted my little kids and, you know, tried to be involved in them a little bit and had lunch, he says, I was thinking about the deal. And so he got in his car. He was late. He had to go. He roared out, had to stop off to a convenience store and get something. And he was on his way to the airport. And he saw this car come up behind him, and it came right up alongside of him. And he said, that's my car. And he says, and he looked at it, and he said, that's my sister-in-law driving the car. And he was going so fast, he said, I'm going to find out what's going on. And so he got behind it, and it ended up in the emergency room at the hospital. And when he got there, he met his wife. And she was just stricken. And he said, what's wrong? She said, well, you were in such a hurry to get out of the driveway, you ran over Joshua, and he's dead. And he said, my whole world just crashed. He said, here I am. Just one more deal. Vanity. Isn't that true? Yeah. Well, that's the message of Solomon. And that's what Solomon gave his life to and ended up blowing it and losing it. Lord, we need this message for men today, don't we? Huh?
Amen.
We need the message that, hey, God does give us, but there's seasons and there's times, and if you leave God out of the equation, you will end up grasping for the wind, and it won't work. And let's go down to number 7, and we're about over, on that business principles. When you look at 5:16, he says, ask the question, what profit has he who has labored for the wind? In his days he also eats darkness, for he has much sorrow and sicknesses and anger. And look at 4:6. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil, grasping for the wind. What's he saying there? What's the wisdom of that? Huh? He says, better is a handful with quietness than both hands full grasping for the wind.
This, in the King James, it says, better is a handful with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit.
Okay. You know, I read that verse and I thought, if that isn't contemporary, you got one hand full and you could have it with quietness. and you could enjoy it. But every business, every management seminar, everything you go to, what's it wanting you to do?
Get the other hand
full. And when you get the other hand full, it's like grasping for the wind and you can't hang on to it, and you got your boat loaded and you can't enjoy what you got. Isn't that right?
When you have both hands full, you don't have nothing to do anything else.
Right. And that's what this guy was doing. He got his hands full, and it's just one more contract, one more job, one more, and he blew it. And he can't retract, can he? He can't.
Trapping monkeys.
Yeah. He got his hand in the pot, and it lost. And look at verse 10, chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves silver will be satisfied with silver. What was that? He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. And this is also vanity. When is enough enough?
Never.
Never. The eyes of men are never satisfied. And that's the lesson we can learn from the Book of Solomon. Look at 13 and 14. This is a severe evil. Riches kept for their owner to his own hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune when he begets a son, for there's nothing in his hand. For he came from his mother's womb, and naked shall he return. Yeah, I was in the bank one day, and I saw a picture, a guy artist, or a cowboy artist, and it showed a funeral hearse with a U-Haul trailer hooked onto it. You ever see that one? And it talked about you can't take it with you. Have you ever seen a U-Haul, you know, behind a hearse? No. It doesn't work. Well, there's a lot of other things that we could cover, but I hope that it stimulates you to think in terms of getting life in perspective so you don't blow it. Like Solomon did. Fear God, keep His commandments, for that's the whole duty of man. And put that, and He's put eternity in your heart so that you know when you're grasping for the wind. And life is not going to be satisfied by anything on this earth if it's not in the season, in the role of what God is providing, and enjoying it and enjoying your work in the context of the reality of God Himself. Well, let's have a word of prayer. And Jim, how about if you pray for us? Would you do that?